Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast Seminar. In today's seminar, our guest is Knut Svanholm, who is the author of Bitcoin Independence Reimagined and Bitcoin Sovereignty Through Mathematics. He's also created several nice educational videos on Bitcoin, such as Bitcoin and the Separation of Money and the State, Bitcoin's Price Curve Will Not Be S-Shaped, and Everything Divided by 21 Million, which is Knut's forthcoming book. So we're here to discuss Knut's books and his ideas on Bitcoin, and I'm sure he's going to offer us with a lot of very interesting insights. So Knut, welcome.
Thank you, Saifuddin. Nice to have a chat again. I believe last time we spoke face-to-face was in Riga in 2019.
Yes.
We've DM'd a bit since then, but not like this. So good to see you again. And yeah. I'm happy to say that I have a mission. I'm the editor of the Swedish translation of the Bitcoin Standard as well. Oh, so nice. I'm also working on that now.
Yes, thank you for that. I hope it turns out very nice. I have no doubt you'll put in great effort into it.
I have doubts about that. I have no doubts about it turning out great anyway, because, yeah, it is one of my favorite books. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get straight into it. Tell us, first of all,
in your book, Sovereignty Through Mathematics. Well, before we get into that, I wanted to learn a little bit more about your background and what got you into, first of all, Bitcoin, but also this kind of unique mathematical and scientific lens you apply to analyzing Bitcoin. Where did you come from?
I come from a different background to most other people in Bitcoin, because my education is like merchant marine sea captain. So I was sailing a tall ship for most of my career, or for at least 8 years. I was on this tall ship sailing the world and seeing like around 40 different countries. And let's do the entire story. After I graduated high school, I got into a university studying electronics engineering. But I was very tired of school at that point and about the bureaucracy and how lame everything was. And, well, the term wasn't invented yet, but in fiat education. So I dropped out after a year, having done the maths courses and basically nothing else. I went out at sea instead and worked as an AB, and later on got into the Merchant Marine Academy and became a sea captain, or at least on paper, and went up working as a second officer and a chief officer on this tall ship sailing around the world. And after that, I've been working for 7 years in the offshore wind industry, first as a captain on one of the crew transfer vessels, small catamaran vessels, and then went ashore like 4 years ago and started as a crew coordinator. And my last job was as a crew manager for that company, managing around 250 seafarers on Danish contracts all around Northern Europe. But I quit in May. I sent them a letter saying that I'm tired of this now. I'm not doing this anymore. And I did my last day of fiat work like 10 days ago.
Wow. Congratulations. Yeah.
So I'm doing Bitcoin philosophy or whatever full time now, whatever you may call it. I haven't really thought out a coherent plan yet, but yeah.
Bitcoin philosophy and shitposting, like basically all of us.
Yeah, shitposting is not a crime. It's a vocation.
It's a mission.
It's a mission. That's the word.
It's, I mean, we, I think every one of us at some level was saved by an older generation of shit posters. Like for me, you know, getting on Twitter and seeing people like Pierre Rochard and Michael Goldstein trolling the no coiners and laughing at them was arguably most influential in me taking Bitcoin seriously and digging into it and trying to learn it and understand it. The power of these ideas is really strong. So don't knock yourself out. It's not exactly sailing ships around the world, but it might even have more of an impact.
It's smoother sailing. And yeah, I have to give it to you. You're a great shit poster and a great inspiration in that regard as well. And Gigi is a good one too.
Yes, Gigi's yeah. Phenomenal about that. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do you go from, well, I guess the link that I like to focus on is the engineering part. I think there's something about engineers being drawn into Bitcoin. There's a lot of engineers in Bitcoin, and I think a lot of engineers have managed to really grasp how it works, I would say better than any other demographic, any other job. You know, I think computer programmers and computer software engineers are at a specific advantage here because they have the engineering mindset and they come from a computer background that allows them to understand it. But I think engineers in general, even if you're a mechanical engineer or an electrical engineer and you don't happen to know much about coding and programming, I think there's something about Bitcoin that fits with that view, with that worldview. I think the corollary to that is that engineers are the people that have the hardest time understanding fiat economics. I remember when I used to teach at a university, there was always, I used to teach, you know, undergraduate basic macro and micro nonsense and, you know, give them all these equations. And I'd explain all of this absurd stuff. And usually I would give them an alternative perspective. But before I give them the alternative perspective, I'd look at them and I'd tell them, does this make sense? And there's always a couple of smart kids looking at me and being like, is this a trick question? Because this really doesn't make sense. And then they look at me and they say, sir, no, it doesn't make sense. I'm like, exactly. You must be an engineering student because this does not make sense. You are correct. If you think it doesn't make sense, you're beginning to get it. Like, the, you know, the business administration students, they don't have as much critical thinking in general on average, obviously, you know, as engineers. But engineers, you know, it's like the system has to click together and it has to make sense. And it has to, all the moving parts have to fit together in order for me to accept it. And you know, when you put a bunch of Keynesian equations and telling them, yeah, we're just going to print money and give it to people and then they'll spend more and then there will be more jobs and then we will have prosperity, it doesn't fly. So on the other hand, you know, Bitcoin, when they see it, they manage to get it quickly. So I think this is the part. But you know, do you think your sailing career helped you in getting into Bitcoin?
Well, maybe seeing a lot of different countries and a lot of different flawed systems, like flawed in different ways. And I noticed that I came to other conclusions than my fellow Swedes did about Cuba and the US, for instance. Like, people really fell for the propaganda in Havana. And like, they thought that people really loved the government there, which they said that they did. But of course they did, because they were under threat all the time. So like, I came to different conclusions. And like, funny thing, you say that's about engineers, because for me, it was always like the harder the science was, the easier it was for me to buy into it. And like it made more sense the harder it was. And mathematics made the most sense. And like the social sciences made the least sense. Until I found Austrian economics, which was like the missing piece of the puzzle to make sense of the world. And like, to me, Austrian economics is to the subjective what mathematics is to the objective reality. And you have to see it through that lens to really get it and to realize why economics as a form of science is just really a big joke. And it was never supposed to be about economics per se, but about studying human behavior and why people do stuff at all. That's like the core thing you have to get at. And your book helped a lot. I'm rereading Human Action at the moment, and I'm reading Hoppe's Democracy, the God that Failed. And I've really read up on the Austrian stuff. I read like Human Action now almost twice, and Man, Economy, and State by Rothbard, and some other shorter books by him as well, and now Hoppe. So I'm listening to Austrian economic stuff all the time. Haven't taken your course yet though, so I'll I guess that's still on my list of stuff to do. I'm sure we can have some great conversations there too.
Yes, we'll give you a complimentary membership for coming on the show. Remind me, Peter. So, all right, no problem. So let me know. The next question I wanted to ask is on your book, Sovereignty Through Mathematics. Can you give us a brief summary of the main thesis of that book for the listeners?
It's sort of the Bitcoin Standard Light. It's only 100 pages long, but it touches on many of the same. I think we wrote them at about the same time and released them at about the same time. I think yours was released a bit. You released yours in like 2018, right? Or was it even 17?
I wrote it in 2017, but it took the publishers forever to get it out. So it came out in March 2018, yeah.
Yeah, I wrote mine in 18. I started writing in New Year's Eve between 17 and 18 and released it in 2019, I believe. It didn't really take off until I brought it to Riga and gave it to some key people in the Bitcoin space.
I remember you gave me a copy in Riga.
Yeah, you were one of those key people.
Thank you, sir.
The first chapter is about how everything we do is really a trade. When we when we talk to each other, we exchange information with each other, and we do that because there's a mutual benefit somewhere. We do it because we want to. I don't have to threaten you and extract the information that way. I can talk to you instead, and we can give each other something of value. And not only do we trade with ourselves, but we trade. Not only do we trade with each other, but we trade with ourselves as well, since there's always a time trade-off. So that chapter focuses on how everything can be viewed as a trade, and not only goods and services, which is really the same thing, but also speech, and like you trade with yourself all the time. That ties into the whole time preference thing. And well, then there's 10 chapters in the book about different aspects of Bitcoin, and it's like trying to capture people's interest and trying to provoke thought in the reader different ways. It's not giving any answers to anything really, but trying to tickle people's brains is what I set out to do with it. And yeah, there's one chapter about Bitcoin can be viewed as financial atheism, which is like the opposite of this Bitcoin as a religion theme that is going through the Bitcoin space now. And it's more like this is a monetary system that doesn't require belief. All the other monetary systems require belief and require belief in a higher power and in especially in authority. So that can be viewed as I compare that to organized religions, and Bitcoin is like the antithesis of that. Like when you don't really need to believe in anything, you just need to understand the mathematical and the game theoretical foundation of it.
Yeah, I mean it's astatism, if you want, which is really the modern version of atheism. In a sense, the state has replaced religion, and
It's another religion. To me, it's just a natural. It's on a continuum. It's another way of organizing and controlling people.
Yeah, and it's a. I think the conclusion that I'm arriving at is that it's a far more destructive and harmful mechanism of organizing religion, because when religion is some guy in the sky, then the main advantage of that is that it's not some guy on earth, and that's what matters. So if everybody agrees that omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence are only properties of somebody in the sky, you know, this entity we call God, it means that nobody else can be God on earth. It means that if you try to be God on earth, everybody around you is going to think that you're a weirdo. But with modern statism, you know, the religion places the God is the state, and the God is whoever happens to be in power in the state. And that's, you know, a lot of people think they're being edgy by being atheists and not believing in God, but I think the real edginess today is not believing in the state, like not believing in the legitimacy of the state. That's what a heretic is. If you want to be a hero, you know, go and try and figure out the intellectual case for why you are able to live your life without having the state tell you what to eat and what to drink and how to behave and who to marry and how to do it.
But I take it one step further. I don't believe in any of it. And I think the very notion of omnipotence, like it's dangerous in itself, and the that you need guidelines to form morality and everything. I think the more people can think for themselves, the better off we are, and come to their own conclusions about the, like. I hope that's the case, at least, and it works for me. I'm a skeptic by nature, so I have a very hard time believing in stuff without seeing like hard evidence for it, or at least hard evidence to the contrary that the other thing does not work, or like you need to really convince me in order to convince me, and it took a while to swallow the Austrian economics bill, but when you do, you really do. Like, I mean, Human Action is the best book I ever read by far, and it's sort of an epiphany reading that book, because you get a different lens on things. Well, that was a while back, so
yeah.
Let's get on where we are today. Like,
yes. So you were saying the sovereignty through mathematics. And in that book, you discussed time as the ultimate example of a scarce and tradable resource.
And, yeah.
Yeah, it's something I also discussed in the Bitcoin Standard. What is it about Bitcoin that gets all of us to start thinking about time? Gigi as well, in his book and his articles, he does a lot of thinking about time, and he calls Bitcoin is time as well.
Yeah, if you haven't read Gigi's article, Bitcoin is Time, please do, because it's one of the best articles. It's probably my favorite articles in the entire space, like article-wise. It's really spot on about what Bitcoin is, and Bitcoin really is time. And time is such a fascinating concept. First, to tie back to atheism, I think that like if I think that my lifetime is scarce, like I don't believe in an afterlife, then that ties in, that's a perfect fit for Bitcoin. Like then I have my lifetime and my Bitcoin, they match, so to speak. Like this is a scarce resource and I should be careful with it and I should cherish every moment. And that can give you a more fulfilling life, if you will, because you cherish each moment. The thing about time, reading Hoppe at the moment, he's got a lot of good insights about it from an Austrian perspective. He talks about being robbed and being taxed being taxed as being slightly worse than being robbed. Because if you're being robbed of something, the robber will probably just choose you as the target once, because attacking you again poses a risk to the robber. Because you might be more prepared for him the next time he comes. And like you might have bought some security equipment, like a dog or a gun or whatever, an alarm system. But taxes, on the other hand, they rob you every month. And like inflation robs you all the time, every microsecond of your life. And that's much worse, because for the victim of a robbery or theft, we react in the same way. The thing that happens to our psyche is that we get we have to think in more high time preference ways. We can't plan ahead for the future as much as we would have if we hadn't been robbed. So if someone steals all your possessions, all you can think of is short-term decisions, like how do I get food? How do I survive? How do I acquire food for the next day? And like, That's the ultimate form of high time preference, right? So, and if you can keep all of the fruits of your labor, then you can have ultimate low time preference. Then you can think across generations and like build things that last. And in that sense, taxation and inflation do the same thing and worse than being robbed does to us. And we're all victims of that. And that's part of why so many resources around the globe are misallocated all the time. And like, I was walking with my mother today in like the streets of Spain here, when you have these little nature areas where people throw, like everyone's a tourist here. So they throw away plastic bottles and stuff. And she thinks it's the problem is with the, recycling in Spain, that they don't do enough recycling. But the underlying problem I try to explain to her is not recycling, it's consumerism and how we buy frivolous bullshit all the time and how we're incentivized to make short-term decisions like that. And if we were like forced to learn from our own mistakes and clean our room, we wouldn't be as wasteful. And that's a huge part of this revolution, and it ties into time, all of it.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with a nice colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree entirely. And I think, the point that Hoppe makes is very powerful, which is robbery is like a natural disaster. You know, it's an unexpected thing that happens to you. It befalls you. It may devastate you financially, but you don't live with the expectation that it's going to happen every day. And so then you may recover and you may go back to how you were before. But with taxation and inflation, because they're legitimized, because the majority of the population generally is essentially brainwashed by government propaganda to believe that these things are legitimate, then you need to factor them in into your future. You know, you got robbed of 30% of your income this year, and you need to remember that you're going to get robbed of 30% of your income every year for taxes, for instance. And then, of course, with inflation, you may be getting a much higher degree of robbery over time. And that just means that, you know, your reward for everything that you do is 40% off. You know, I get X in return. Well, I'm getting actually 0.6X because X is always getting robbed. So the likelihood of you investing for the future declines. The likelihood of you working for the future declines. The amount of work that you put in will likely decline. All of these things, all of your discounting of the future rises. So high time preference rises. Time preference rises, basically. And I think, yeah, your book touches on that very nicely. So you also, in Sovereignty Through Mathematics, you discuss how hyper-Bitcoinization is likely to progress exponentially at some point. We can't grow at a slowing rate. Why do you think that is the case?
Yeah, this is a really interesting part, because this is the part that I really wanted to discuss with you, Safe, because we've made a video called you mentioned it there, that like Bitcoin's price curve won't be S-shaped. In that video, in Sovereignty Through Mathematics, but even more in that video, I talk about hyper-Bitcoinization and first and foremost, it's inevitability, because everyone's incentivized to be hyper-Bitcoinize themselves. There's like very few people on earth that wouldn't gain from like adopting this thing in some shape or form. And what happens then, like most people imagine hyper-Bitcoinization as an S curve, like the TV had, or radio, or the internet, or Facebook and Google. They all had an S-shaped adoption curve where nothing happens in the beginning and there's a catch-up effect phase where everyone's onboarded. Like, remember when smartphones happened, for instance, it took like a couple of months and then the entire globe was had a smartphone, including all the poorer countries as well. Like people flee from countries, but they flee with an iPhone most of the time, or an Android. But money is a different beast. When everyone on earth has some Bitcoin, that's not the end point, because when everyone's on board, there's still more money to put into Bitcoin. And those people that get it, like Michael Saylor is doing for now, for instance, or like they're all the more you understand Bitcoin, the more of your wealth you want to allocate into Bitcoin and not into other stuff, because Bitcoin will perform better over time. And say when we're fully hyper-Bitcoinized and every dollar and euro and yuan and every other shitcoin is in Bitcoin, and there's no more shitcoins. We really share the world among these 21 million tokens. I don't see an endpoint there either, because what we have then is a global sound money free market without interventionism, which is a much, much more well-oiled mechanism for human progress than what we have now. We have to remember that what we're living in now is a handicapped system. It's severely handicapped. It's like a dog on three legs, the world economy. And it doesn't doesn't really do what it's supposed to do. And resources get misallocated en masse all the time. But like I see a world where you get the velocity of money from necessity, because people will crave to be paid in Bitcoin. So all the whales will have to spend there. If they want to buy something for their Bitcoin, they will have to give it to those that have less. And like it's doing that right now. It's really spreading the resources, spreading the wealth across the globe. This is also a fascinating aspect, that it's actually redistributing wealth by doing the exact opposite of what socialism does. So Bitcoin is actually, in reality, redistributing wealth. But at that point, my point being that world looks very different from what we have now, because no resources get misallocated. No resources get wasted, or well, maybe that's utopic, but a lot less resources get wasted. Fewer resources get wasted. That's the proper grammar. And we will have not only a steady expansion every year, but an accelerating one. I don't see an end to this. This invention or discovery could be weirder than we think. It could like be something that we truly can't wrap our heads around. If there's no endpoint to hyperbitcoinization, what does the world look like in 100 years from now? That's like impossible to predict. And yeah, I'm looking forward to like the next 10 years are going to be weird, and the 10 years after that are going to be even weirder. What do you think about these things?
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you on the fact that we have no idea just how much better life is going to be once we take money out of the hands of the state. I think the example that I always like to use is compare the average Soviet citizen's experience with potatoes under communism versus under the free market. So right now, if you're in Russia or in Poland or an ex-Soviet country, you walk into any supermarket, you find potatoes, you buy them whenever you want, and you know it's there year round. You find mangoes year round in Poland these days. Back under communism, you know, I had a friend who grew up under communism in Poland. She told me once that she would get an orange for Christmas. Like that was what life was like when the government handled fruit production and distribution.
Now, at least the color was right.
Yeah, I didn't check. Who knows? You know, Polish oranges may have been blue under communism.
It's all subjective, man.
Yeah, but you know, you think about the degree of improvement that has happened to the market for apples and oranges and potatoes when we've moved from a system of central monopoly provision to a system of freedom of provision. And it's just completely unfathomable. Like if you've taken the average Russian who was not very familiar with the outside world, who was, you know, a little bit parochial and just grew up under Soviet system, and just imagine this would be the Soviet system. If you told them, you know, we're going to move to a system where there's not going to be a potato board anymore, there's not going to be a government agency responsible for potatoes, their first reaction would have been, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're all going to starve, you know, forget. And they wouldn't have noticed that, you know, they have an agency for potatoes, but they don't have actual potatoes in their supermarket, or they rarely have them. And it's the same exact thing with fiat. I think one of my most shocking experiences when talking to people about it is particularly in Lebanon. You know, in Lebanon you witness now the currency has collapsed, the banking system has collapsed, everything is in shit. And you talk to people, because they are prisoners of this system, they're mental prisoners of the system, they believe in it, they believed in the banking system, and they had their money in the bank, and they have a vested interest in that banking system functioning. Their reaction to Bitcoin is, well, what happens? That can't work because there's no central bank behind it. Like your central bank has really helped you, and that's really worked for your lira, which has lost 95% of its value over 2 years. But I think this is kind of the same thing. It's unimaginable for people under living in a mental prison to think about how much life would be better. And I think we can imagine people like us who are into Bitcoin, who have taken the orange pill. We can imagine that things will be better under Bitcoin, but we have no ability to imagine what they would actually be like. Imagine the world after 150 years from the gold, 120 years or 110 years from the gold standard. It's the first time that we have hard money in 110 years, but we have a lot more technology because we've developed all of the technology that we developed under the gold standard has developed under fiat. It wasn't all fiat wasn't all hyperinflationary, death and destruction and war. We did have years of relatively low financial, relatively low monetary inflation, and so there has been development and some capital accumulation, and it's been amazing. Now, to imagine what would happen with this with Bitcoin is it's amazing, but I think one way to think about it is that we're probably not going to have these things called GDP statistics. There was no such a thing as GDP statistics under the gold standard, and I don't think we'll have this nonsense under a Bitcoin standard, because this is a function of fiat. This is one of the paraphernalia of government control of money. The government promotes its control of money as being for the good of the people, as being for the good of society, and then they need to manage it, and they need to run the money supply with the pretense of it being for the good of society, and therefore they need all of those statistics, and they need to spend all of your money on collecting statistics on how they're doing with managing your money. But I think in a world of hard money, I think everybody will have more pressing things to do with their life than look at aggregate numbers that don't matter. Then this is, I think, the key conceit of macroeconomics, is just because you can construct a metric like GDP or unemployment or aggregate demand, immediately it follows in the nerd brain and in the brain of people educated in the 20th century, it immediately follows that since we have those metrics, let's make a relationship between them, and that relationship is causal. And this is basically the big methodological gulf between the mainstream and the Austrians. For the mainstream, we have macro aggregates, and therefore those macro aggregates are the causal forces. The unemployment rate went up, and so GDP is going to go down, and then inflation is going to do this. And if we do this with inflation, then we can get that one up. It's like you're a pilot clicking at controls on an airplane. And you press this button, the airplane goes up and it goes down. But Austrians, and this is kind of the powerful realization that you get when you start understanding Austrian economics, is they'll tell you this isn't you being very educated and smart and intelligent when you're looking at these statistics. You're just you're basically just falling for the conceit of knowledge. This is the fatal conceit of imagining that just because you can measure something, then that thing will continue to have. That thing is the explanatory and causal factor, but in reality, for the Austrians, what causes things to happen is human action, is individuals. It's micro foundations. It's individuals acting, and individuals act, and then these statistics are kind of like epiphenomena on the top that we measure with it. A little bit of a long detour, but what I was trying to get at is that I would imagine life will continue to keep getting better. But I'm not so sure that we'd be able to measure it in the same way that we can measure it now in terms of Bitcoin going up. Because once we've killed all the other monies, how do you measure the growth in GDP?
Yes, and this ties into the rest of my thought thread here, because I've been thinking a lot about this lately. First of all, to tie into your points, I think the word is arrogance. People who think that they can outperform the free market in calculations, they're just arrogant. Like the free market, as I view it, the sound money free market of the Bitcoin economy is the only defense humans' minds have against the AI revolution, because that's how we can learn how to cooperate and make something good of it, instead of it being a self-destruction mechanism, which it will become if someone is arrogant enough to think that they can control the economy. But anyway, this about the Bitcoin standard and how do you measure it post-hyper-Bitcoinization. I I take it so far that I don't think that Bitcoin will ever be a good unit of account. And I base that on the never-ending hyper-Bitcoinization. A ruler is good because it's a meter long, right? Or of 12 feet long or whatever some other stupid system uses. But a Bitcoin ruler would be from 0 to 21 million, but it's still a ruler that approaches infinity in purchasing power. So it's not really that useful. We have to remember that during the golden years of the gold standard and the Belle Epoque that you talk about in the Bitcoin standard, gold still had, it matched like the inflation of gold sort of matched the progress of human ingenuity, so the prices became quite stable. But Bitcoin doesn't have that inflation in the future, and you could argue that it doesn't have that inflation even now, because everyone knows that there will never be more than 21 million. So you have constantly declining prices and constant increasing purchasing power. Chances are that we might never be able to use it as a good unit of account. It might make more sense to use like kilowatt hours, for instance, or something tangible like that, because Bitcoin is so abstract that it might never be useful as a unit of accounts, even though everyone will want it as a payment. As you say, it might be very hard to measure things in Bitcoin terms.
No, I think I disagree here. I think it's hard to measure something like GDP growth, because value is subjective, and therefore you can't really measure the total amount of production that's taking place, because it's also another aggregate measure, and aggregate measurements are just ridiculous. But I think I disagree with you on two things. First of all, I think right now, you know, we're at a very fast phase of Bitcoin growth, because Bitcoin is going from 0 to 100% of global balance sheets, global cash on balance sheets. So currently, Bitcoin is about 0.5% of the world's balance sheets. If you looked at all of the amount of cash and cash-like assets which people hold, which, you know, we can argue about what counts as cash and what people hold as a cash substitute. I'd say, you know, it's government money, checking accounts, saving accounts, but I think the major one is bonds. The majority of people who have money don't have their money in the money that they want to sit on, the money that they want to save for the future, the one that they think of as being low risk, they put it in bonds, which, you know, let's take a moment to laugh at that. So if you think about it, then that's maybe something like $200 trillion, $300 trillion. And I discussed this in detail in the fiat standard. So there's about $200 trillion out there that are in bonds and government money and checking accounts and saving accounts and similar instruments. And maybe you could add stock indices. So that, all of it, is money that people just want to hold on for the long term, and they don't want to take a risk with it. And the notion to go to somebody who has any of that money and to tell them, actually, what you should do if you want to really keep that money for the future is put it in this new digital currency that's out there, you're going to get laughed at. And we've all gotten laughed at many, 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 many times. And it's going to be a lot of years of people laughing at this, but then eventually reality will catch on, because we're seeing what's happening with the bond market all over the world. Bonds are getting destroyed as a unit of as a mechanism for saving, and Bitcoin is just continuing to go up. So, you know, the trend of the last 10 years, it's very hard to see it reversing either in bonds or in Bitcoin. Governments are not going to learn fiscal responsibility. Bonds are not going to go back to being good stores of value. And Bitcoin is not about to become hyperinflationary, and its supply is going to continue to remain fixed. So because of this, we're going from zero to a couple hundred trillion dollars. We're at about $1 trillion right now, a little bit more than $1 trillion at the time of recording. So you think about it this way, you know, the potential for fast growth is enormous right now. But then once we get to a world in which everybody's cash balances, you know, are in Bitcoin, you know, there's no longer any such thing as a government bond. Nobody holds government bonds. Nobody holds stock indices. If you want to make an investment, you make an actual investment. Maybe there will be stock indices, but they would be used as investment rather than as cash, which is what people use them as right now. If we lived in a world like that, where the majority of wealth was in Bitcoin, there's not going to be the ability, I think, to double everything by 100% per year. I don't think that that's likely.
Really?
Yeah. I think because, I mean, we'll continue to make marginal improvements and make things better and better and better, but...
So how many percent per year?
Well, I mean, I think, like, you know, under gold, we probably had something like 1 or 2% increase in the majority of goods. But in the 1 or 2% decrease in the price of the majority of goods per year on average. So maybe it'll be 10, maybe it'll be 20. But I can't see it going much, 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 much higher.
Okay, let me try to argue against that. Because first and foremost, because it's fun.
Yes, please. But, that's what we're here for.
Yeah. So if you think about the computer the AI that figured out chess or figured out Go, it took that algorithm like 4 hours to beat the previous computer, like Deep Fritz and Deep Blue and whatever they're called. I don't remember which one is which now, but it like teached itself how to play chess in 4 hours, and then it beat every other player on earth in that short amount of time. And imagine now we're post all the fiat currencies, we're post all the shit coins. We live in a hyper Bitcoinized world, and we have the free market, the collective brain of the free market, like human intelligence utilized in its most efficient way possible because of this global sound money free market. Which enables us to use these tools of AI and robotics and whatever. So all the production costs of everything are approaching zero. All the transportation costs of everything are approaching zero, especially denominated in Bitcoin. And they're approaching zero fast. And at the same time, Bitcoin gets redistributed, over a population of at least 8 billion people. And when you have 8 billion people holding some amount of Bitcoin, the chances of them losing some of that Bitcoin somehow is greater. And like people die all the time, and most people will probably die with their Bitcoins, and they are not recoverable after that. Like hodling is a human action in a way, but it's also the lack of an action at all, because dead people can hodl. Objects can hodl Bitcoin. Like you don't need to be alive to hodl Bitcoin. And if you think about it, I think that these forces are so powerful that, well, maybe not 100% per year, but I think 15 to 20% per year in just human progress or purchasing power is too low. I think there's an even more optimistic way of looking at this, if you think about it that way. Because I think it underestimates how bad the system we live under now is. Because as you said, we utilize like 0.6 out of one work week, because the rest of the 0.4 we work for the government, right? If you count taxes and inflation. And if you live in Sweden, you work like 0.3 for yourself and the rest for the government. And that is
basically... Sounds fair, because at least they don't make you cover your face with a diaper. So.
yeah. But anyway, I'm trying to make the argument that there we might all be underestimating the power of this. Even the most bullish among us might still be underestimating it. Of course, there might be, as you say, it might level out some in the beginning of the hyper Bitcoinized era, so that we just have like 5 to 10% growth per year. But then that might increase again, and we might have another J-shaped curve going somewhere else. And I think it's very hard to think hard about these things without coming to these conclusions that this is at least possible for it. When you count things like AI and progress in general, and 8 billion people truly cooperating with each other and not like leeching off each other, but truly cooperating, it's hard not to see it be even weirder than we think. So,
yeah.
This is the part. Yeah.
Yeah, let me kind of counter to that. I think one useful way of thinking of this, which I discuss in the Fiat Standard, is Michael Saylor's way of explaining inflation, which is that inflation is a vector, which is an absolutely brilliant insight, which I hadn't heard anybody mention before him. Most people like to think of inflation as a number. You know, CPI came in at 5.4 or 3.2 or 7.8 or whatever. And it's like there is this number. And of course, you know, governments want to have these numbers because if you reduce reality to a number, it's very easy to manipulate one number as opposed to manipulating all of reality. And then you end up with, you know, we've had 50 years of inflation destroying the American economy and 50 years of idiot Keynesian economists telling us that actually inflation is only 2% and 2% inflation is actually good for you. But putting that aside, the point is that there will be different goods. So, for instance, when it comes to processing power, when it comes to hardware, a hard drive capacity on your laptop, these things can probably grow at something like 50%, 100% per year. You know, you might end up with this massive amount of improvement. In fact, we may not even need Bitcoin to get to these kind of levels of improvement in these industries. Perhaps if we just didn't have the cancerous state leeching on all of our resources, perhaps we'd have we'd already have that now. But then you look at things that require labor, that require human attention, and I think I don't know. I don't believe we will ever be able to get rid of that. So there's always going to be some element of value that other human beings bring. You can't just live off robots all your life. But I think even though Bill Gates' vision for the future seems to be that, you know, we're all going to be stuck in front of a screen watching all of the lives that others used to experience, we'll watch it mediated through a screen. I still think there's value for personal interaction. There's always going to be value for taking a class with the best teacher, sitting in the same room with the best teacher, getting to meet them, getting to know them, getting their attention. That's the key thing. There's not going to be a million best teachers. So we can't continue to make that infinitely. There'll always be the best musician, the best violin player, the best. So we can't witness a 100% improvement every year in the quality of violin players or in the quality of school teachers or university lecturers. These things, I can't see them increasing and becoming more and more popular to the point where we would get 100%. And so,
okay, just for the violin player, we can imagine a world where it's infinitely cheap to see this violin player perform on a augmented reality type of thing, the thing Bill Gates is talking about. Well, I mean, regardless of whether you call that an improvement or not, maybe the tickets for actually being close to the violin player will be more expensive, but the experience of seeing and hearing the violin player play might be a lot more accessible, like everything has become with like the digital revolution. I mean, just an MP3 file proves that, right?
Perhaps, but I think I like to go back to something I read on Mircea Popescu's blog, which is, you know, this kind of mentality will one day replace building a house and having a marriage with buying a sex doll.
That's not what I'm saying. And I'm saying, like, I mean, if you have enough Bitcoin, you can find a place to stay where you want to stay, and you can have ribeyes every night, and you won't even have the urge to buy any other frivolous shit, because that's all you need, basically. And so it takes away the need for buying frivolous shit. But then again, experiences can still be cheaper and cheaper. It's hard to imagine something going up forever. But okay, let's get on to the next point.
Yeah, but it's just that I think that some products are by their very nature scarce, and by their very nature, they're desirable for the fact that they're scarce. There's only going to be a few people that will ever be able to say, you know, I watched this guy in concert live, and I don't think that, you know, sitting in an augmented reality place will ever really compare. I can't see that. Obviously it will compare. It's better than just listening to, maybe it will be better than just listening to an MP3. But we're not going to be making, you know, master violinists every year at a 100% increasing rate.
Yeah, but now we're getting back to the core of Austrian economics, that like economics does not apply to things that aren't scarce, like air, for instance. If air is not scarce, it does not have a price, and we do not need to negotiate about it. And that's what I mean. We might get a future where all the things that we spend our money on today are so abundant that we might have very few real needs. Well, of course, there's space on the earth and like houses and ribeyes, because you can't really reproduce the experience of sleeping in a bed and eating a ribeye. But other than that, everything else can still be a lot better than it is today. And I think that, like, post hyper Bitcoinization, we'll see all that play out, and we'll really have a very much better future experience wise.
Yeah, I think that we don't disagree on that. But I'll going back to the point on unit of account, I think where I disagree here is that people seem to confuse the idea of something being used as a unit of account with it having to remain stable. And I think this is something that Mises addresses specifically, which is back in Mises' day, the Keynesians were obsessed about making money's purchasing power stable, because suddenly, you know, the Keynesians discovered this crazy, mysterious, unexplainable phenomenon like the Loch Ness Monster, where prices were rising for some unexplainable reason, even though their theories clearly predict that, you know, their money printing is not going to raise prices, it's only going to make the economy better. And one of their, you know, one of the ways in which they try and gaslight and rationalize this is to say, well, you know, we can't just have gold, because then with gold, you know, prices won't be stable, because we don't have a central bank who's able to stabilize prices. Because what if people want to buy more money? People want to dump stuff and buy gold, then the price of gold goes up, and then if they want to start spending, the price of gold goes down. Oh no, we need a central bank. And Mises says, you know, it's not being a unit of account, being a unit of measurement, does not equal does not mean money's value is stable, because the things are always changing in value, and money is what you use in order to measure it. The value of money cannot really be stable. That's the key point. So what Bitcoin allows us, which I think didn't exist in the time of Mises, which I find to be a fascinating point, is that it's the first constant in economics. It's something that is in itself constant, in that there's only going to be 21 million. So we always know that we're measuring this against a ruler that is this long. You know, we have a constant ruler for all value, which is 21 million Bitcoin. And everybody in the world can find out where they all are by just running their own Bitcoin node. So I think it would still function as a unit of account, even if it was rising in value at 10, 20, maybe even 100%. That's its job. You know, it's the best unit of account we have, because it's the one thing that is constant in its quantity. And then that gives us a very good idea about what is happening to the scarcity of other things. So we'll notice that, you know, apples are becoming 2% cheaper every year. Computers are becoming 50% cheaper every year. And we'll see these trends reflected, and we'll be able to measure them. So I think we can still use it as a unit of account, even if it continues to go up.
Yeah, my concern is really not about that, that if it really turns into a gold 2.0, which most people think like post-hyper-Bitcoinization looks like. But if apples are dropping in price by 200% per year, it's a different matter, I believe, because then we live in then it's really not more useful as a unit of account than the Venezuelan Bolivar.
If it drops by 200% per year, that means it goes up by... No, it can't drop by 200%. It means they pay you to eat apples.
Okay. Maybe I got the linguistics wrong there, but I think you get my point. Like if it's, yeah, I know that price stability is the biggest lie ever told to man, because, and I think that the rise in Bitcoin's price right now is a reflection of that, how fooled we've been by these. By prices remaining stable or going up over time, when they really should have been going down at a faster and faster rate because of how much cheaper production really is now and how much cheaper transportation is compared to like 1971. So my concern about the unit of account is just that we're so used to thinking of prices as relatively stable. So if we get something as like the literal opposite of the Venezuelan Bolivar or the Turkish Lira, post hyper-Bitcoinization, because Bitcoin's value goes up or purchasing power goes up so fast, so that it becomes hard to measure. I mean, even in El Salvador today, you buy a hamburger at McDonald's and use your Chivo wallet, the unit of account used is the dollar and not Bitcoin. And it converts it into Bitcoin because people are so used to thinking of things in stable prices. And I know Mises argued, as you say, he argued that this was a fallacy and that it would be possible to do another way. But we have to remember, Mises never experienced Bitcoin and he never imagined a monetary good that was absolutely scarce and absolutely finite.
Rothbard did, though. There's a piece called The Austrian Theory of Money by Rothbard, in which I'm not sure if it was in that piece or somewhere else, but I'm 90% sure it was in that piece, where he says, if we could by some magical way invent a money whose supply was fixed, that money would work perfectly fine. And that was one of my very formative moments. I read it maybe 2008, 2009, and it completely blew my mind. And just there was no coming back to Keynesianism after it. This was like one of the knockout punches. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, The Austrian Theory of Money.
Yeah, really interested in that, because what I think of when I think of an absolutely scarce thing of other than Bitcoin, I always draw the comparison to the Salvador Dalí paintings, of which there are 13 left in the world. And like, try to imagine pricing things in parts of the Mona Lisa. Like, if Mona Lisa is 21 million Bitcoin, like there's one Mona Lisa, it doesn't really matter if it's one or 21 million, right? As long as it's infinitely divisible. So if you tried to divide the entire world economy in parts of the Mona Lisa or parts of the Salvador Mundi or whatever the other really expensive painting is called, you run into the same problem. But I'll have to read Rothbard's piece before I dig an even deeper hole here for myself.
No, I gotta say, Rothbard is like a great cheat sheet. It's a great shortcut. That's productivity hack. Like, there's a lot of Mises is a great mind, but Rothbard has this incredible ability. First of all, he has the advantage of being more contemporary. Rothbard was much younger than Mises, and he was English was his native language, so it's easier for English speaker to get Rothbard, and he writes in English as opposed to Mises, who even when he wrote in English was really writing in German. But Rothbard had an incredible ability to summarize very complex ideas very briefly. So there are a few Rothbard articles that if you read them, 10, 20, 30 pages, they will give you a very, very, very good understanding that you would otherwise require many, many hours of reading very dense texts to glean. I think this paper is one excellent example, The Austrian Theory of Money. There's another great paper on the end of socialism and the calculation debate revisited. I think this is an absolute masterpiece of a paper. It's also brief, maybe 10, 20 pages or so, maybe 11 pages. I may be mixing it up with another one, but it's pretty brief. And it was written in 1992, I think, right after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in it, Rothbard goes through one century almost, well, 70 years at that time, 70 years of debates on socialism from Mises' first paper, and then the responses, and then the counter responses, and then what Hayek said and how Hayek is different from Mises. He summarizes it all so clearly that you come up with an excellent, excellent understanding of the topic, which, you know, if you wanted to really develop that without Rothbard's help, you'd need to read a lot more. So I highly recommend these pieces.
Yeah, I really love The Anatomy of the State, which is another, it's a book, but it's a short one. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What else we wanted to talk about? Your idea of digital scarcity. One of your this is an idea that I really like in your work. How is Bitcoin digital scarcity, and what does this tell us? What does it mean?
I tend to avoid the term digital scarcity nowadays, and I like the term absolute scarcity or absolutely finite a lot better, because the digital part of it is not the most interesting aspect of it. It is interesting in the sense that it can utilize the internet for faster communication, but that's not the real discovery here. The discovery is something mathematically finite that we can subdivide infinitely into smaller parts, and via like layer two solutions like the Lightning Network, we really can. Base layer, it's 100 million of a Bitcoin, a Satoshi per coin, but they are really more divisible than that if you take them off chain. I believe that this is a discovery rather than an invention, and I believe that Bitcoin is an agreement first and foremost. It's an agreement between us Bitcoiners on a fixed set of rules, and we all believe that these rules are fair, and that's why we, and you may disagree about these rules, and you may disagree about that we actually found absolute scarcity and all these things, but then you can't have any of the benefits. So Bitcoin is for those who buy the who can see the mathematics and the game theory behind it and buy into that, and if you do, you can also enjoy what Bitcoin can give you. But if you don't, if you try to, it's like working, sailing against the tide or trying to prevent the sun from going up the next morning. If you instead like view this as what it is, an emergent natural phenomenon that is happening, and you work with it instead of against it, you can get something out of it. But if you work against it, good luck, because what are you going to do about it? And this is why I believe it's inevitable that everyone will hop on board sooner or later, because it's just an agreement and it's just an idea. And how do you stop that? How do you stop people from agreeing with each other? It's practically impossible. This is how I try to explain it. When people ask me the question, what is Bitcoin and what is absolute scarcity these days, or like, why is it important? My first thing is like, we've all agreed on that this works and that it's finite, and this is how we ensure that it's finite. And as long as we agree upon that, there's no stopping Bitcoiners.
Yeah, and this is the thing. This is where it can appear that like it is being just a bunch of Marxist socially constructed stuff that, you know, we agree that Bitcoin is money and therefore Bitcoin is money. And it's like, you know, what Harari or David Graeber say, that money is just a social collective hallucination where we all agree that toilet paper is money and then we all start using toilet paper as money. And I think there's a very important distinction here with the point that you make and that I make in the Bitcoin Standard, but also in Principles of Economics, my next textbook on economics, which is that it's not about just agreement. If everybody got together and agreed that let's use toilet paper as money, we're not going to have a monetary system. Toilet paper is not functional as money. It won't work. You know, no matter how hard we hallucinate that toilet paper is good as money, it's not going to work. We're going to end up with having, you know, each house is going to be 70% toilet paper, and it's still going to continue to lose value, and it's going to be absolutely terrible. And people who would use it will just simply destroy their wealth. On the other hand, Bitcoin can work. So it's not about hallucination. That's why I love your term discovery. It's we discover this thing that works in that way. And it's not because we decide to hallucinate that we're going to use it in this way that it works. It's because it can actually work. It's because the people who do hallucinate, to borrow a stupid Marxist term, the people who do hallucinate that Bitcoin is money end up you know, achieving the ends that they want to achieve from using money. It holds its value. You can send it across the world. And 5 years later, you find yourself with a big smile on your face because it has done much better than your local governmental shitcoin. Whereas people who hallucinate that toilet paper is money or people who hallucinate that, you know, let's use fish as money or let's use water as money, they just end up with no money. They won't have the function of money fulfilled. So it's really the discovery, and that's a term that I like that you put in, that it's not that we invented digital scarcity as much as it is discovered. And this, you know, it's not so much that it is that again, it's just because we will it to be that way, because it can work that way, and that goes back to the go ahead.
The agreement part is that we agree on a fixed set of rules. We don't agree on that this is money. We agree that this is a fair set of rules for expressing value, and that's a totally different thing. It's not like agreeing on toilet paper. It's agreeing on a fixed fair set of rules. And if we want to upgrade it or change it in some way, shape, or form, we all need to agree that that's a good idea. So that's how I view it. I don't view it as, like, as you say, those people that think that it's just a collective hallucination. It's much more of a discovery, as you say. And that ties into, like, how showering first and then using a towel differs from using the towel first and showering afterwards, because the order of things matter a lot here.
It's not because we have a social hallucination that we collectively agreed that we have a social norm that we use the towel after we shower. That's not why it's different.
No, exactly.
The example that I like to give to Marxists when they tell me this is, you know, everything is socially constructed. Okay, everything is socially constructed. Yes, of course, we can say that everything is socially constructed, but, you know, you could say, there are real properties. If everybody decided to hallucinate that they're going to use sandpaper instead of toilet paper, you can choose that hallucination, but, you know, there are consequences to using sandpaper instead of toilet paper. And it's the same thing with money. If you were going to use less hard forms of money when other people have the harder form of money, you're just not using money. And this is, I think, is an excellent, very powerful argument against altcoins. If you accept that altcoins are similar to Bitcoin, then you are opening yourself up to a world where all of these new shitcoins continue to increase in supply individually, and then more and more shitcoins are being introduced, and then they increase in supply collectively. So if you have that situation, then you don't have digital scarcity. But the good thing about it, the reason why, you know, it's not like we're just saying this because we don't want people to do shitcoins, and, you know, please don't shitcoin. If you start shitcoining, then our Bitcoin won't work. It won't be scarce anymore. No. Again, it's the market that does this. It's not a hallucination. If you continue to use the scarce Bitcoin, it'll continue to be scarce. If your node continues to enforce the consensus parameters where there's only 21 million Bitcoin, then you don't care how many shitcoins get introduced, and you don't care about how insecure the shitcoins are, and you don't care about how many shitcoins get added and what happens to the supply of any shitcoin. You're stuck with the 21 million. So it works. So it's a discovery of a system that is self-contained and can work. That's and it has the scarcity.
Yeah, it's like the discovery of a new continent. Like, Columbus could only make that journey once. That's one of the comparisons I draw. But our latest video collaboration is called "Why Everything That Isn't Bitcoin Will Fail," and there I talk about shitcoins, and we like divide them into two subcategories, and one is cryptocurrencies, which are all the shitcoin, the altcoins or cryptos, and the other is kleptocurrencies, which are all the fiat currencies, which are also shitcoins in a way. Like, a shitcoin for me, the definition is basically something that isn't Bitcoin, something that is in some shape or form designed to steal your time. Or can be used to steal your time. Even if it wasn't designed, it can be used later on to steal your time by someone. And if it has that property, it's a shitcoin, and you shouldn't use it. Basically, you should upgrade to Bitcoin immediately. It will be better for you because they're finite.
Very much so. Very much so. I agree. All right. So Now, moving on to your next book, or the previous, actually, the first book, Independence Reimagined.
Now, that's the sequel.
Oh, no, wait, that is the second book. That's right. Yeah, the second book. Yes. So now tell us a little bit more about that. What is the main idea in that book?
There's no real coherent thread into that book. It's more like I wrote that while on vacation here in Spain for during Christmas. So I woke up 2 hours before the rest of the family, and I wrote for an hour, and I went out jogging for an hour. And that turned into that book. And it, more of like I had to make a follow-up now that I wrote Sovereignty. But that's it's been very well received, and it touches on different aspects of Bitcoin again. And one chapter is about collectivism and why collectivists win elections, because the main thesis in that, and that's like the last chapter I wrote, but it's one of the earlier chapters in the book. And I find that in hindsight, I find that with one of the more interesting aspects of it. And it's about how the less individualistic you are and the less independent of a mind you have, the easier it is for you to form large groups, because you don't care that much about what that group actually thinks. So you're happy with being a sheep and saying ba ba and walking in line and just doing what you're told and whatever the great leader tells you to do. And this is an inherent flaw of democracy that I don't believe even Hoppe talks about this in Democracy, the God That Failed, which criticizes democracy in other ways. But as I view it, it's very hard for independent thinkers to form large groups because of the individualistic nature of their thinking. That they're not afraid. You're not afraid to disagree with people, and like the earlier on, if you look at the generations in Bitcoin, like the earlier on you are, the more disagreeable people are, and like Bitcoiners are getting nicer and nicer generation by generation, I think, and more agreeable. But in the beginning, it was really horribly disagreeable all the way. I don't know where you fall into this on this scale, let's say, Fadeen, I'm not saying that it's a good or a bad thing. I'm just saying that the more individualistic you are, the harder it will be for you to form a large political group. And therefore, socialists win everywhere because people like to belong to a group. People like to watch other people. I know you're a football fan, but I've tried to find it interesting, but I just can't wrap my head around why I should like vouch for the one team rather than the other team, because I think they're all just chasing a ball on. I don't get it.
Let me make the counter argument to that. So the counter argument I usually give to that is that. Is when you say football is just a bunch of men chasing a ball around a grass field, it's for me it's like looking at a book of poetry and saying it's just a bunch of ink on a piece of paper. I don't understand why people like
okay.
that.
Okay. Yeah.
But the other point to go to your idea about getting excited about a team. I think the case for that is that there is a very strong tribal instinct in us as human beings, and I think modern sports are an excellent civilized way of releasing that, where you go and instead of gathering around with your friends and beating up a bunch of other people, instead of getting worked up about foreigners in another country who do things differently from you, and then deciding that we need to take it out on them, because like this kind of tribalist mindset is it starts by otherizing, by making the other look inferior, think of the other as inferior, and then you justify atrocities, and then you become inhuman for you. And I think football is a great way of deflating that, because instead of going out and carrying arms and shooting them and killing them and destroying their country, you get excited about 90 minutes, and hopefully you get the ball in their net, and if they don't, they get the ball in your net, and then you feel like shit for a day or two or a week, depending on how emotionally invested you are. But then guess what, your home still works. It's not like you fought a war and then they came and they destroyed your house or you destroyed their homes. So it's a very peaceful outlet for this kind of tribal instinct, which I think I think I don't have empirical evidence to support this, but I think people would be much more worked up about much more dangerous ways of being tribal if they didn't have sports as an outlet.
Yeah, I totally agree, and but I think we have different levels of tribalism in us. I mean, more some people are more keen to of course, like people are different. Some people need the tribalism more than others. Some people need it for their identity. Like I identify with, like if I didn't have this soccer team or whatever, like I identified with like metal music for a long time, and that's sort of a tribalism as well, right? But
Yeah, but you don't hate soft rock people. You don't make them an enemy. Where's the fun in
yeah, there might be styles of music where I do detest the people that like it, but but anyway, what I'm saying is that like I totally agree that with like we need these outlets for those tribal things, and it's the same with yeah, emotions of anger can be can be I think most people who listen to metal music are friendlier because of it, because they get their aggressions out by doing that or by playing metal music. And it's
Yeah.
about I think there's a connection there to like vouching for a soccer team.
Very much so, very much so. Yeah, I think I to go back to your original point. Yeah, I think I agree with you on the fact that collectivism is I think the scam of democracy is precisely that it presents collectivism and slavery and control of others, so human subjugation of other humans. It legitimizes it by attaching a popularity contest to it. I think this is really the scam, in that all cultures, all religions, all societies all over the world have a moral code which is pretty constant all over the world, which is, don't steal. Yeah. I mean, and everybody knows what's wrong. Everybody knows that murder is wrong, that assault is wrong, that theft is wrong, that rape is wrong. There are no cultures which view those things as correct. There are cultures that might justify them in certain conditions, where other cultures might not justify them in certain condition in these same conditions. But there's a very clear idea of what's right and what's wrong. And the scam of modern democracy is that it has managed to completely subvert people's common sense, explanation and understanding of what is right, what is wrong, theft versus murder versus consent versus coercion, completely subverted that by attaching it to a meaningless, stupid popularity contest for a bunch of actors. And that's what it really comes down to, because the actors that are in power, usually, particularly in modern democracies, they don't rule shit. They're just puppets. They are. This doesn't have to. It's not like there's an evil cabal of people moving them around. It's not conspiratorial. It's very basic political science. You don't get to become president unless you satisfy the most important special interests in the country that have the power to bring about a president. And it may be different from one president to the other who the special interests are, but ultimately the president is just an actor who looks good and can talk properly. Well, talking properly is no longer one of the criteria anymore. They're mostly basically unable to speak these days. But that's the thing. Like, if you just vote for this one guy, then everything that his team does is now legitimate because democracy is accepted. And so you end up in a society that is actually far more tolerant of aggression, repression, coercion, when you have this stupid popularity context attached to it, as opposed to a society where people just accept that those things are wrong regardless of how they're done. And that's really how Aldous Huxley makes that point, by the way. I've seen an interview with Aldous Huxley, who's an incredible thinker. And he says, the reason that leftists win elections is that elections are a leftist thing. The idea that we, the people, can take your stuff if we get enough of us on board. That's leftism, So the people who oppose leftists, they run on a platform of, we're not going to take rich people's stuff. We're not going to take anyone's stuff. We're not going to destroy capital. And where's the fun in that? You know, that doesn't get people excited and worked up. Whereas leftists run on a platform of, oh, if we win the election, we're going to take all of the nice things and give them to you. And obviously, it's extremely idiotic, but a lot of people are stupid. And so they do vote for this.
Yeah. For those stupid people out there listening right now, I'd like to...
They're not listening. I think we've alienated them in this podcast early enough.
But if there are any stupid people left listening to this, here's my attempt at trying to explain it to you. Like, if you take wealth from the rich and give it to the poor, you incentivize being poor and you disincentivize being rich. It's as easy as that. And you will, as a result, you will have a larger poor population and a smaller rich population. People will no longer want to be rich. They will want to be poor because you get money for nothing by doing that. And that is so destructive. And it's not only about being poor or being rich. It's about all kinds of destructive behaviors that get promoted by the pity people take at different groups, in small minority groups and stuff that get special treatment, and you incentivize them to emphasize on the bad parts of like if you have hate crime laws, for instance, you incentivize people to separate into and to identify with different races, because if you have a hate crime law, it's good for you to identify as a certain race, because then you can claim it was a hate crime law. And so all of these political measures to meddle with people's existence are ultimately destructive. And
absolutely.
And it's just awful. And it's very hard to see from within the system.
Yeah, I'll add one point to this, which is generally this is the most common criticism that people think of when they think of the problem of socialism. They think, well, incentives, and then you're destroying the incentive for people to work. But I think there's a more powerful argument, which is what the Austrians make, and that's the calculation problem, which is you think that you're just taking money from the rich and giving it to the poor, but what you're actually doing, and that's kind of the advertisement, but what you're actually doing is that you're taking money from people who are productive and giving it to parasites in offices who then decide what to do with it. And yes, they might give a little bit of it to the poor, but the most important thing is that they are the ones responsible for allocating it. And so you move from a world in which the people who produce things on the market are able to generate money and then are able to accumulate more capital, and then they control the productive capital of society. And because they are able to control it profitably, they continue to accumulate more of it, and they continue to use it more profitably and more productively. You move from a world of that happening, where you know the market process is constantly increasing the wealth for everybody, because we're always able to make economic calculation because the calculation is being done by the people who own the capital. When you try and transfer it, you're drawn by silly collectivist ideas. What you end up doing is you're not allocating the money and the resources, in particular, you know, the productive capital is not being allocated by the people who know how to produce it and who know how to use it productively. It's being allocated by people who have never used capital productively, people who win popularity contests.
Yeah, it's wasted. That's what it is.
Exactly.
And like, you know, capitalism has been, it's blamed for so many bad things in the world. But what people don't realize is that we've never really had true free market capitalism, or very few instances. Like Hong Kong, for instance, is an example everyone. But even there, it wasn't pure. So people say we haven't tried real socialism, but in reality, we're trying real socialism all the time, and that's to blame for everything, and not the other way around. What we haven't tried is real capitalism.
To be fair, we also have not tried real socialism. Nowhere has ever actually went out and tried real socialism, but we've gotten close, and it's the same with markets. We've gotten close. The closest I think we got to real socialism was Cambodia. When Pol Pot took over in Cambodia, he banned money, and he shut down the cities, and he moved people to the countryside, and he got everybody to go out there and start working in food production. That's the closest we got to socialism. And the result, of course, was that he took over Cambodia with a population of 8 million, and 8 years later, the population was 7 million. So more than a million people perished from starvation and mass murders in concentration camps because you had close to real socialism. If we had gone all the way to real socialism, there wouldn't have been anybody left in Cambodia. That's the difference. On the other hand, you know, we haven't had real capitalism, but we've also come close. We have Switzerland on a gold standard up until the 1970s. We've seen how that worked out. We've had Hong Kong. We've seen how that worked out. So, yeah, we don't have to try the pure 100% unadulterated version of both in order to understand there's a serious difference here. When capitalists say this isn't perfect capitalism, you know, we still have all of the production, all of the valuable stuff that's being made is still the function of capitalism. It's being produced because of capitalism. Whereas when we don't have perfect socialism, we just don't have perfect genocides.
No, it reminds me of a Mises quote, like comparing capitalism to socialism is a bit like comparing fresh drinking water to potassium cyanide.
And exactly. Yeah. And we'll never have pure, 100% pure. Maybe you'll never drink one pure 100% water and you'll never drink pure 100% potassium cyanide. But we can pretty much tell, you know, you 99% is good enough to give us an idea of the impacts.
Yeah, definitely. I have a couple of questions here in the chat.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let's see here. I'd like to ask Knut on his view. Peter asked this. I'd like to ask Knut on his view on whether the world is getting more centralized governmentally. And yeah, there's a twofold answer there. Well, hyper-Bitcoinization is happening. So no, it does not apply to us who are already on board. We don't care. Honey Badger doesn't give a shit. But like from the looks of for those who are still in the fiat system, yes, it is getting more centralized, definitely. And just look at how hard it is for the smaller states in Europe to get out of the clutches of the EU. I mean, I was all pro EU up until my 20s or something because it was all about a union where we shouldn't a trade union where we could trade between borders, and I like that. It wasn't until later on that I realized that what were the borders doing there in the first place? Like, why do we need a free trade? A free trade agreement is an oxymoron because that means that someone took away our ability to trade freely between each other. So to answer your question, yes, fiat government is getting more centralized. But we have bitcoins, so we don't care, or we don't have. We lost them in a boating accident. Coach Kiki, does Knut still sail? Does he foresee sovereignty on the high seas?
That's a good question.
I do still. I wouldn't say no to sailing if someone wanted me to sail. I don't do it professionally anymore, and I choose to do other things most of the times in my spare time because I don't consider myself as having that much spare time, even though I'm not working. I think I already did my fair share of sailing. I mean, I have quite a history in sailing in traditional ships. I was in the tall ships races twice, and I can proudly say that we ended up winning a prize both times, once in third place and once in second place in the tall ships races. So, and I've sailed around the world and seen a lot of places. So I feel very done with my sailing career. Sovereignty on the high seas. Well, I like the seasteading ideas, and some of it is a bit far-fetched, and like the waters of the world are controlled by states. Of course, you can get out. The further out you get, the more sovereign you get, I guess. You feel very, very free and very imprisoned at the same time when you're on a tall ship in the middle of the Atlantic, because you know that you can do whatever you want. But then again, you only have this boat to do it on. But in theory, no one can stop you from doing anything at the high seas. So there's some aspects of sovereignty to that, but I don't really know if that's. I think we need to focus on, or we'd rather just focus on Bitcoin and hyper-Bitcoinization and how to adapt to it and how to think about it and how to use it personally. That's more forward thinking than trying to build these futuristic cities in the ocean. Of course, I find the ideas interesting, but well, that's not where my focus is. Hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I think perhaps more realistic, or maybe not realistic is the correct word, but I think more attainable for most people than seasteading, which is kind of difficult to pull off. I think sailing might be a great place to be free, because you spend a lot of time in the sea, you leave countries and you go in and out. It allows you the flexibility of moving around between countries and not being tied down to one of them, not having a lot of stuff that ties you down in one particular country. So I think, you know, sailing across the seas might be a useful way of escaping the current insanity that we see.
The smaller the vessel, the easier it is. In regards to countries, it might be harder in the middle of the Atlantic, though, but that's another problem, another set of problems. I love Michael Saylor's story about how he couldn't get his money out of Argentina, and he had to buy a yacht and sail it to the West Indies and sell it there. that was like the only way he could get it out of the country. So yeah, really love that story.
I had not heard that one before. All right, Daniel has a question for you.
Guys, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. I popped down to the bar to get a beer and listen to you guys jam. And as you can see, safe. I even brought my olive tree, my investment here with me after listening to Taleb's advice. I take it with me everywhere I go. It's brilliant investment advice from your old friend. But one thing I want to touch on with Knut is a tweet he put out a while ago, and we touched on this already in a different conversation, but I think it's really important for other people to hear. He tweeted out something along the lines of, guys, we've had this wrong all along. It's not number go up technology, it's number go down technology. And that just kind of kicked me in the balls when I read it. And over time, it's taken on different meanings to me, because yes, of course, we have the halving, that's number go down. Bitcoin is going to be lost, and that's number go down. And then you guys were kind of alluding to this earlier when you're doing the unit of account conversation. Everything we're ever going to want to buy in life is going to be number go down as well. So I would just love for Knut to kind of expand on that thinking a little bit more. And are we psychologically ready for this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Daniel, and a bit insulting to say maybe who came up with the term number go up. So, but I think we mean the exact same thing. I mean, number go down is what enables number go up. The we can only find abundance through scarcity. That's what I mean by it. If you're thinking about it in these different ways, then the tweet had the desired effect of like provoking that in people, because the years that you still have left in your life, that number is going down. And as you say, the number of Bitcoins is going down over time. And it's like everything but the purchasing power of Bitcoin is going down. And this is what enables the purchasing power of Bitcoin to go up. So number go down is an interesting concept. I don't believe I was thinking of anything specific when I tweeted it. It's just like, yeah, you know how it is. You see something and you play with words and you turn it on its head, and people think about things in other ways after you do. And that's sort of the point of it. But yeah, number go down is as important as number go up, of course. We wouldn't have number go up without number go down.
This is the next Bitcoin civil war, I think.
We'll have to, yeah. Your citadel versus mine.
Yes. Up or down, that's going to be the fight of a lifetime.
Yeah.
Anybody else have any more questions? We also wanted to talk about your next book, everything divided by 21 million. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I decided I was like writing is a tedious process, and it takes some dedication, as you know. And I was not wasn't really sure if this is what I wanted to do or not. Maybe I should just focus on these little movies I do or something. But then and I started writing like some mid through two chapters, but I'm not as happy with them as I would have liked to have been. But then this Saturday, Jeff Booth came over with his family for dinner here. And like I was swimming in a waterfall with him yesterday. So we hung out for a couple of days here. And he was really like, I mean, I only have younger brothers. And as my younger brother said, it was a good thing he came over, because you've always needed a bigger brother. Because he gave me a great pep talk about focusing and like trying to... He really thought that I should focus on writing another book and making it accessible to people. So it's like I have the title and I think I have the opening line, which is this book is about you and yes, you. And then the rest of the book is about the reader of the book, regardless of who the reader might be. And so I'm doing the opposite of what Alex Svetsky is doing, which is like discluding everyone that doesn't understand Bitcoin and like just keeping it for the remnant. I should try to explain these hard concepts in layman's terms for a bigger audience. I think that's a good way of spending the rest of the year. And I really need to get working on it. I I take long walks, and my mother is here now, so I'm taking care of her a bit and like getting all settled in here in Spain and finding out all sorts of different excuses not to get started writing. But I bought a grill.
Excellent. That's a valid excuse.
Yeah, it is, right? Yeah. But the theme of the book will, of course, be everything divided by 21 million, and then how to explain these concepts in layman's terms, like drawing from some of the video content and some of the articles I've already written. And then like I will also try to focus on those ideas that are still somewhat original, because I think it's very hard to be original in this space, and it's getting harder and harder by the day, because there's so much great content out there, and there's so many great articles and great books, and like the market is getting flooded. So like all of us are trying to find my own voice. And I know you had the same problem when starting writing the Fiat Standard, right? Say if you didn't really know what your next book was going to be about, and then this idea of like using the Bitcoin lens to explain fiat comes to you, and like that's how I'll write the book. I think you said something along these lines on another pod I heard. Is that right?
Yes, I think it was more, to be fair, I think it was more of a just needing to get my head around fiat and figuring out what to write about it, because it's you know, when I started writing about Bitcoin was what, 8 years old, and it was still relatively small, but fiat is 100 years old and there's a lot going on, so it's not as easy to wrap your head around it. No, I've been, to be honest, I've been writing uncontrollably over the last 3 years since finishing the Bitcoin Standard. I wrote the Fiat Standard, which is going to be out next month, and Principles of Economics, which I've written like 70% of it. I have still got a couple of chapters to finish. Subscribers are getting them. I'm getting a little bit late because the last chapters are a little bit more elaborate. But yeah, I think, I don't know, I think... you just need to turn up and plug at it, and just stop, shut down all those voices that keep coming up with ideas for you about why you shouldn't, and just go and put your, you know, the secret to writing is putting your fingers on the keyboard.
Yeah, that's really true, and I really disciplined myself when writing the last book just like that, and I wrote as often as I could, and as efficiently as I could. So I'll have to get something like that going. I'm thinking of switching from my gaming laptop to my ordinary laptop as a first step. Like there are less distractions there. I've been playing StarCraft with Hodlonaut a lot lately. So, and like when you're doing all this, I mean, Bitcoin Twitter and like meeting all these people and just chatting with, yes, a random phone call with Daniel or whatever, like meeting other Bitcoiners in real life or like this, it's just so great. So, so you tend to like do that a lot. But I need to manage my time better. That's all in fiat life. That was always sorted out with like you work from 8 to 5. So I need to get a similar thing going, like discipline myself.
Go back to fiat.
Haha. Then again, like most of my writing is not done actually sitting by the keyboard, but walking around thinking about things. That's I think that's like at least 80% of the process. It's just thinking about things and trying to get an idea good enough to fish for while sitting by the keyboard. And realizing that ideas are like a fish is a good metaphor. Like I think it was like Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age said this about songwriting, but like it's about when you catch a nice, it's like fishing. When you catch a nice fish, it's the fish that is beautiful, not the fisherman. So it's not about you. It's about what you write, and you need to focus on not letting your ego get in the way of what's in the text. That's what I'm trying to say, I think. This sounded old. That I don't.
No, I agree entirely. I agree entirely. I think the difficult thing about writing is shutting down your ego, which wants to sound like a smartass, and sticking to the plan of what you want to actually write. You know, just get to the point and trying to just. This really was maybe one of the most helpful things I ever heard about writing. I don't even remember where I heard it, but it was really transformative and it made me a much better writer. Somebody said something along the lines of when they asked Michelangelo how he carved David, and he said, "I looked at the marble and I took out everything that was not David." And I think this is a great way to think of writing. You know, you can pound the keyboard for a week and you'll make 100,000 pages of text. But that's not the difficult part. The difficult part is trying to get the text that gets your point across. And so it's like chiseling through all of those letters to get the exact correct letters in the exact correct order to get your point across. And it's pretty liberating when you think of it this way, because your job is not to make your language flashy. Your job is not to prove a point to the reader that you're a good writer. Your job is to communicate the idea. And it's just, you know, it's just that it's easy to think of this, but it's extremely hard to stick to it. It's just, no, focus, get back to the point. Just bring out the David. Make the David come out of your keyboard. You know, just take away everything that's not there, and just be ruthless in eliminating all the little extra details that are not needed.
Yeah, it reminds me of an old saying about engineering, which is like an invention is not done when there's nothing left to add, but when there's nothing left to take away. So and it's the same with writing. I agree completely, and I do believe that. Benny Andersson of ABBA, this is again about songwriting, but he said like the key is to sit by the piano when the song is in the room flying by you. Like if you don't sit by the keyboard, when the idea comes to you, you don't get the chance to write it down. So, and that's like sitting by the keyboard and actually being there when the thought pops into your head. That's a huge part of it too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Felipe wants to ask you about the sat symbol. What are your thoughts on the sat symbol? He says that's the next Bitcoin civil war.
And I'm enjoying this civil war a lot. Like because Bitcoin Twitter and shitposting, it's not about that. Like nothing left to carve out. It's about sounding like a smart ass, and like, it's just as much as about that, and I enjoy that too. So well, there's been a lot of debate. I don't really like the kebab looking thing with the three lines and the line through it. I think it's a bit too complicated, because I think you should be able to write this in handwriting easily.
Yeah,
I like handwriting, and handwriting we'll just use keyboards. Well, that's not the point. It's supposed to look good.
And also, it's probably too complicated, and not if it's difficult to write, it's difficult to be able to decipher at small sizes. It's you can think that it's an E, or you could think that it's something different. Yeah.
Yeah, the same goes for this, like the sat that is like an at, like in an email address. But when there's an A with a circle around, the S with a circle around, that's not really natural to write either. There was some guy that posted like something, he said it was inspired by me and Gigi. So already there, he had my full attention. And it was like the infinity sign. It's called a lemniscate in mathematical terms, but turned on the side, so it's actually an eight with a line through it in the middle of the eight, and that looks kind of nice, because it sort of looks like an hourglass, and the Bitcoin is condensed time, and this is the connection to Gigi, and like I really like that, because it was easy, and I tried to I don't know if you saw that, but I posted like I tried to handwrite it. I had to do it with my thumb on the phone, but it's kind of easy to write an eight with a dash through it. If you begin from one side, write the half the dash first, then the eight, and then the other side of the dash. So it's more like writing an S, but like I kind of like that. Then again, I think this is a non-issue, because time will tell what symbol we will use. It's like the Bitcoin tickers. Everyone uses BTC. Like for the ticker for Bitcoin now, no one says BTX or whatever we were using before, when all the exchanges use different tickers. It the market will take care of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the natural replacement in the long term is going to be the dollar sign. People are used to seeing that, and eventually it's going to make sense. But I think it's going to be probably tricky to begin to using it now, particularly, I think, as I would imagine, soon enough, you know, sats and dollars are going to be in the same range of value, probably within our lifetime. And so then
for a short time.
Yeah, it won't be very long, but it's going to make for an awkward transition period. So I think perhaps it's just going to be as simple as a letter S, and you know, an S before a number denotes sats. So S22.
You know, we're getting back into the usefulness as a unit of account rabbit hole here from another angle. If we can't even agree on the actual unit and how to write it, like anyway, we'll see what it turns out to be. I think the time will have to tell.
Okay, fantastic. All right. Anybody else have any more questions for Knut? No? All right. Well, Knut, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me discussing on.
Yeah. Cheers. Thank you for coming. And do take the courses and do start joining us in the seminars now.
Yeah, I have the time to, so there's really no excuse.
No, you don't. You should be writing.
Okay, then.
All right, I'm joking. No, you're welcome to come anytime.
Yeah, I'm sure I'd love them. And I'm sure it would be even more annoying than Gigi.
he wasn't annoying. That's not fair. He was always fun. Gigi was like the best student in the first class. When I first started teaching, he was like figuratively, we didn't have a classroom, but if there was a classroom, he would be the one in the first row, the first to come into the class, and have all his pencil case lined up, and you know, raises his hand to answer every question, and always knows the answers.
Not surprised at all. did he have his green suit on?
No, it was just he never showed up. He was just always talking from behind the closed camera, unfortunately.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Saif. I really enjoyed this, and we've been going at it for almost 2 hours, and I think I got the points across.
Yes, absolutely. Time for us to go grill some steaks now.
Exactly.
Exactly. All right.
Take care.
Cheers, man. Take care.
Cheers. Bye.